You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of March 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show...
Rex and I have been talking about this for a long time. We got along actually quite well, but we disagreed on things. When you look at the Iran deal, I think it's terrible. I guess he thought it was okay.
US Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is out, replaced by CIA's current director, Mike Pompeo. My guests, Daniela Pellet and Jeffrey Howard, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including an attempted assassination of the Palestinian Prime Minister, and we discuss if visits to concentration camps should be made mandatory in the German curriculum. On today's show, we also look at why Poland is banning Sunday trading. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Daniela Pellet, Managing Editor of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and Jeffrey Howard, Lecturer in Political Theory at University College London. Welcome both to the programme. Now, to start the show, more changes at the top of the US government. President Trump announced today that he'll be replacing Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State, choosing the current director of the CIA, Mike Pompeo, to fill the job instead. We're getting used to the high staff turnover in Trump's presidency, but was Rex Tillerson's sacking really a surprise? Well, Jeffrey, we'll start with you. I guess a surprise it didn't happen before, because most people seem to think he's been, let's be fair, a disaster.
Well, I think we've known for some time that the president hasn't liked his Secretary of State, not just because his Secretary of State called him a moron, but because they've had substantive disagreements about lots of different issues, about North Korea, about trade, about the Iran deal. And as we know from the past couple days, about their attitudes toward Russia, we know that even though Rex Tillerson had reasonably warm relationships with the Kremlin, he wasn't reluctant to call them out when he thought they was doing something wrong. And indeed, he called them out just earlier today about the chemical attack in Britain.
Now, that is the essence of the problem, isn't it? Especially on issues like Iran. You know, Tillerson was a believer that actually the agreement had some good in it and should be stuck with. And Trump's, you know, whatever you think of him, his approach to foreign policy is the same as in real estate, really. We can get a better deal if we're a bit harder and we push a bit harder. And that wasn't something he'd ever get from Tillerson, would he?
Which is puzzling, you might think, because I think the reason he was initially attracted to Tillerson was because of his business experience. And indeed, in many respects, Tillerson has been a somewhat unorthodox Secretary of State. He's spent a lot of energy focusing inwards, trying to reorganize the State Department, trying to dismantle elements of the State Department that he thought weren't working as efficiently as they could be. But in terms of his general attitudes toward foreign policy, he's been reasonably orthodox. And I think one reason that Trump has resented Tillerson so much is that he seems to be pressing a lot. He seemed to have spent his time as Secretary of State pressing a lot of the traditional foreign policy lines that Trump wants to resist.
Now, Daniel, I know you can talk about anything, but let's just focus on a part of the world that you know super well. We have, in the coming weeks, some sense that they want to bring together all of the Gulf leaders to bang heads there and see if they can get some agreement about, you know, the Saudi blockade. They have some obviously strong policies regarding Israel, the moving of the embassy. Now, in Mike Pompeo, do you think they have somebody who's going to do what Trump wants and actually be even tougher in the region?
Well, I think certainly on a number of issues, they see eye to eye. And I think the major dominant one will be Iran and the Iran deal. It's very hard also to understand what can be practically done now, because it's not a bilateral deal. There's a number of parties involved in this, and some measures that Washington can take to tighten up the Iran deal. But the idea of it's just a matter of Tillerson was unwilling to just tear it all up and start again is a bit of a misnomer. Again, it's very hard to see quite what America could substantially achieve in any of these foreign policy objectives when the general attitude is chaos.
Yeah, but give them a break. We thought they could do nothing in North Korea. He's achieved more than Obama achieved in two administrations. Now, we may not
agree with all the man's policies, but that is more than anyone else has done in a decade.
In North Korea?
Yeah.
I remain to be convinced. It's not, it can't just be the president's personal whim. There has to be a policy behind it. There has to be a strategy behind it. The idea that...
His strategy is come round to my house, we'll have burgers and we'll agree on something, which may sound stupid, but he's got an approach to foreign policy which is more informal there, that has broken down barriers that Obama couldn't leap over.
It doesn't sound stupid so much as frightening, because what happens if the two guys really do get on? I mean, that's an apocalyptic vision of foreign policy. But it has to be joined up. There has to be, foreign policy has to include diplomacy, it has to include the economy. It has to include wider interests. And I think Trump has had this kind of crazy idea of who is he siding with. He's against Iran, but somehow takes the Iranian side on some matters of foreign policy. And he opposes Russia, except he doesn't. That seems quite clear. And there is a lack of unity and a lack of alignment across the administration, which just can't work. And the more chaotic foreign policy gets, the more it emboldens other actors. I mean, I can draw a fairly straight line towards what's happening in the White House now and towards Russian moves, for instance, elsewhere in the world.
Jeffrey, Tillerson in recent months has said, yeah, I'll take a 30% cut to my department over the coming year, and another 27% cut the following year. He seemed to have very little kind of interest in the machinery around policy. Mike Pompeo, he comes from a bigger institution. Do you think we'll see a more professionalized version of Tillerson now? Because the interesting thing, here's a guy who comes from the Tea Party movement, who, again, you think may be on the same page a little bit as Trump, thinking, actually, you don't need all this machinery. We can do with less government.
I think it says something about what a puzzling situation we find ourselves in, that despite being, I think, an awful Secretary of State, I'm quite nervous about the departure of Rex Tillerson, because he was, by all accounts, a voice of reason, a voice of sanity, someone who would have said, don't just give Kim Jong-un a meeting, which is the prize that Kim Jong-un and his father certainly have been striving for decades. That should be the outcome of a long, careful, very careful, studiously planned process of negotiations. And I think certainly what's happened here is that Rex Tillerson was the voice of reason, despite implementing all sorts of terrible policies, despite dismantling many important elements of his department, despite abdicating America's role abroad as the main defender of human rights and democracy. I'm quite nervous about Mike Pompeo coming in, because he agrees with the president so much. It was quite striking in the press conference today. They asked Trump about Mike Pompeo, and he said, I like Mike, quote, we have a very similar thought process. I think it's going to go very well. And this is not what you want. You want people on the inside who disagree with you, who are going to challenge you, who are going to offer an alternate perspective. I'm very worried that Mike Pompeo is just going to be a yes man to Donald Trump.
But do you think that is true of the Obama administration, which we now kind of wrap this halo around? Do you think that Obama wanted people sat next to him who didn't agree with him?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think one thing that's coming out of the Obama administration is just how much Obama wanted people around him who disagreed and who learned through witnessing his aides deliberate, not just so he could play them off against one another in terms of their personal relationships, which seems to be what Donald Trump does, but because he genuinely wanted to see he wanted to reason his way through the big challenges they were confronting by hearing these alternative points of view. That's why he had someone like Samantha Power, who would be his conscience in effect, constantly pressing him to be more interventionist, to do what's right for human rights, while having more reluctant voices on his other side. Yeah.
And finally, Daniel, on this topic, if you're sitting in various capitals around the world, who will be rubbing their hands? Do you think the Russians will be more pleased with this appointment? Do you think the Israelis will be more pleased with this appointment? Who is this change good for?
Well, the Israelis will be delighted, because Netanyahu's number one obsession is Iran, and he's having an awful lot of wobbles at home at the moment. And there may be elections there in June. So any movement on Iran will be good for him, will be seen as a win for him. Certainly the Russians are delighted about chaos anywhere in the world, and this feeds perfectly into their wishes. I look on it with a growing sense of horror. It would be one thing if the growing chaos in the White House might be leading to impeachment, or perhaps some way in which Trump's descent into further and further chaos might be put to an end. But I thought at the beginning of his election that perhaps the institutions of American democracy would be robust enough to deal with this episode. But I'm getting less and less optimistic as time goes by.
One more thing to say about this, though. The timing of this is quite conspicuous. So the story has just been released that Trump's longtime associate Roger Stone apparently potentially had contacts with the WikiLeaks founder in 2016. Then we know that the WikiLeaks was working closely, so it seems, with the Russians. We know that there's an ongoing scandal regarding the actress Stormy Daniels about a potential payoff that might raise legal concerns about violating campaign finance rules. And so it's true. Here we are talking about the ouster of Rex Tillerson, and it's really, really big news. But I think this may well be yet another carefully orchestrated attempt by the Trump administration to control the headlines and bury the more damning news that's out there for them.
So it's either chaos or it's all carefully planned. We shall find out probably in the coming days, because we were going to move on now. This morning, an explosion went off in the convoy carrying the Palestinian Prime Minister Rami Hamdallah during a trip to northern Gaza. The Prime Minister was unhurt after the attempted assassination. The Palestinian Authority was quick, though, to hold to blame Gaza militants. Hamas quickly rejected the accusation, saying that the claims are only playing into the hands of Israel. Daniela, it's hard to speculate, but who do you think was potentially behind this attack?
Well, it's particularly hard to speculate because there are so many people with interests and there's so many potential actors here. I mean, relations between Fatah and Hamas are, as ever, very sensitive. And this this visit to Gaza was much heralded as an important step in progress, and it was cut short. So who would want to derail it? I mean, certainly the Israelis are not out of suspicion. Hamas are not out of suspicion as well. I mean, the explosion happened on a piece of territory that they're supposed to control very closely. It's quite possible as well that there were Salafist militants also getting involved in this. It's also possible that there was an attempt to scare the Prime Minister and the head of security that were travelling. What's clear is that, once again, any hope for reconciliation and a reunification between Fatah and Hamas has again suffered a serious setback with this.
Jeffrey, assassination attempts are intriguing because there is still this view that you take out the top person or one of the top people and the whole institution falls apart. But they fail mostly in that sense. They are purely demonstrations of, you know, our ability to attack your side, aren't they? But what do you think could have been achieved here? What was it, the ambition, do you imagine, behind such an attack?
So Rami Hamdallah seems like a pretty formidable figure, and so wiping him out of the equation certainly would have been an important achievement. I mean, this is a guy who's quite serious. I mean, as we look ahead for a few years in the future and wonder who might be the next president of the Palestinian Authority, his name certainly is on a lot of people's mouths. I mean, this is a guy who lost three kids in a car accident in 2000. He's a very serious and academic. He's a linguist with degrees from Manchester and Lancaster. I mean, he's a quite worldly guy, and he's a guy who's clearly quite tuned into the politics. And as a moderate, I think, is someone with, you know, quite significant potential to achieve greater Palestinian unity. And so I think he's an obvious target for that reason.
Now, Daniel, you were saying earlier on that you felt this may even play into the Israeli elections.
Well, I mean, there are so many factors involved. I mean, the strange thing is, in the upcoming elections, the Palestinians won't really play a great role. It's a sort of a peripheral issue in a way. Certainly chaos in Gaza and infighting between Hamas and Fatah will reinforce the generally held and popular Israeli view that there's no hope for peace and there's no progress, and the best we can achieve is to keep the status quo with perhaps some economic benefits for the Palestinians, which is certainly Netanyahu's view, and no one is really challenging it. So that's another chaotic incident on the periphery of the Israelis' vision will only boost their view that only a strong leader can keep things calm and stable within Israel.
Well, we're going to move on, but you're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Daniela Pellid and Jeffrey Howard. Coming up next, though, should visits to concentration camps be made mandatory in the German curriculum?
Monocle has bureau around the world, in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, London, Toronto and New York City. In Hong Kong, our bureau chief is James Chambers.
There's no such thing as an ordinary day in Hong Kong. On any one day, I may be interviewing a city mayor or having coffee with a hotelier or chatting with an interior designer and then trying out the latest bar or restaurant. And mixed in with all of this, there'll be some wacky or outrageous news coming out of China which deserves to be covered on the radio. So it's this variety that I really love about the job.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House, and still with me, as you may have heard in the background, are Daniela Pellid and Jeffrey Howard. To Germany now, where Sorsan Cebil, a German state legislator with Palestinian heritage, is trying to make visits to Nazi concentration camps mandatory. The proposal comes at a time when Germany is experiencing the resurgence of the far right with the party Alternative for Germany, the first party of its kind to enter parliament since the Second World War. Jeffrey, you can understand the reasonably good intentions around this, but lately we've seen numerous stories in the media and online of two things. One, schools' children bused to go to concentration camps where they then have selfies taken and generally behave in a not very dignified manner. And also, the theft of objects by school children who've been sent to these camps. There's nothing very important about going. The significance surely should be that you have some sense of connection with the events once you get there. Do you think it's misguided then or wise to bus in students?
So I think it's a mistake if we're thinking of this as a panacea, that all you need to do is one day out of the year, at some point through your 17 years in public school or whatever it is, you go to Auschwitz and there it is. You have this great connection to your past and you suddenly take ownership of Germany's history. You appreciate the fragility of liberal political order and you become a good citizen. That clearly can't be the strategy here. It has to be that these field trips punctuate a larger process through which appreciation of the horrors of the past is integrated through the school curriculum. So it's not just about the one field trip. It's about the novels they're reading. It's about the plays they're performing in their drama groups. It's about the music they're learning about. It's about the novels and the nonfiction they're reading. It's about infusing the curriculum with an appreciation of the kinds of injustices that have taken place in the past and giving people a really good sense that this isn't just a relic of ancient history. This is something that happened in the grand scheme of things relatively recently, and it could happen again.
Daniel, one of the things that there's been a suggested here is that if you go into a concentration camp, you won't vote for a far-right party. But young people especially are informed by what they see on the web and the net, and I don't know that many of them don't actually wonder whether this was true, what really happened. Their investment in the facts is very scant. Do you think that it would persuade people? I don't disagree with it, but it's the same shock tactic in a way as showing you an awful image on a packet of cigarettes. The idea that if you see a glimpse of horror of whatever kind, it would change your behaviour and fix you for the good.
Yeah, I agree that it needs to be part of an integrated strategy, and it can't just focus on anti-Semitism as well. I think it has to address the challenges that Germany and Europe indeed are facing with immigration and the result of the Syrian war and the refugee crisis. There's a very interesting scheme in the UK where two sixth formers from, I think, many, many schools are taken on a trip to Auschwitz by the Holocaust Education Trust, and they're seen as ambassadors and they come back to their schools and give presentations. I think that's perhaps a more meaningful way to go rather than as a routine trip that people take. In Israel too, it's not compulsory, but it's very much a standard part of the curriculum that teenagers in the last years of school go on a visit to the Polish concentration camps.
Yeah, but that's like, you can see there that the very nature of Israel as a country is still very much shaped by those events.
And, you know, many people are, you know, the call to be in the army and all those things. There is a kind of, it's a network of events that is so associated. It would be hard. And it's your relatives as well.
But I think the fact that it has just become a standard part of almost the curriculum has devalued it as well. People take this as, I know of more than one person who's, the trip has resulted in some sort of romantic entanglement, should we say. The kids, it's like a week away in Europe. And, you know, the Israeli kids take selfies too. I think kids will selfie. And it's also part of this very almost frightening narrative of the world being against us. And it's not integrated into a wider view of what happens, or the ultimate evil, if you like. And I think that's the same thing for European kids and German kids. It needs to be part of a wider view of the lessons of history and made relevant to what is happening today, rather than just what happened to Jews and other minorities 70 years ago.
Now, I'm not exactly sure of all the reasons Mr. Chipley is suggesting this, but often people suggest that German children should go to concentration camps so that they can see the sins of their fathers and that they can understand that their relatives were bad people. But at which point do you think, Jeffrey, you have the... We're talking now often about people who are second generation after the war. At what point can you say, do you know what, this isn't my story. I've done nothing wrong. I'm a good, integrated citizen. I accept diversity. I have no anti-Semitism. I don't want to go. It's not my story.
Yeah, I think there are probably two arguments you could advance to justify this kind of a policy. One kind of argument is this kind of sins of the father argument. It's the idea that because you're a member of German society, you bear special responsibility for atoning for the sins that your country has perpetrated in the past. And I'm quite skeptical of that argument, that people who weren't alive at the time of some great injustice have a special responsibility for that injustice. I think there are some contexts in which this is true. So, for example, to the extent that all of us in the West continue to benefit from the legacy of colonialism, you might think we're implicated in a larger structure that has duties to attend to the existing disadvantage in the world that generate from colonialism. In this case, though, I'm quite skeptical. And so I'm more motivated by a second argument, which is the idea that old school children should participate in these kinds of experiences and learn about, as I say, the fragility of liberal political order, the ways in which institutions can crumble and human rights abuses can become very, very easy and in a relatively short period of time through dangerous speech and through the entrenchment of a certain way of looking at human beings that marginalizes them, that humiliates them, and that looks at them as less than human, we can get to a situation where ethnic cleansing or even genocide is happening. So I think this is something that we should do everywhere in all society. Indeed, I think Germany is probably particularly resilient as a liberal constitutional democracy. So the argument isn't that Germany is uniquely vulnerable. It's that all human beings everywhere should get education that teaches them about the vulnerability and fragility of liberal institutions.
Daniel, if we were saying this goes back, a couple of generations, maybe you should be involved for one reason or the other, and not comparing events, there is nothing on the scale of the Holocaust and would never want to compare such events. But we made a reference there, for example, to Empire. Should British students, two from every class, be sent to Africa to see India, see the impact of massacres and the worst side of colonialism? Should two American students from every class be sent to Vietnam to see what was done to villages there? Because surely it's the same sense that you have some need that you should face your country's past.
I think that's the danger is you take an approach like that, and even with taking trips to concentration camps, you sum up a very, very complex issue in just one moment and one point. This needs to be our stories rather than particularly located in a country or a national heritage. And I think if you start browbeating British children about the legacy of colonialism, it's a guaranteed way of making history less relevant to them and of putting them off and turning them off and them disassociating with the whole issue. I think we can teach with empathy without making such a clear sort of cause and effect. And Germany has done it very well, I think. Germany is a great example. Maybe it was just with its general sense of doing things well, but how it has dealt with its own history and even its more recent history, even the way that it's managed to rebuild divisions from East and West Germany, I think is a very good example of how you can face up to your history without, in a way, fetishizing it and getting overwhelmed with feelings of guilt, which are fairly pointless, really.
Well, I think certainly here in the UK, if you suggested that anything was wrong with empire, there'd be one or two newspapers that would suggest you were mad, that it was all kind of pims and pomp and it had been a rather glorious moment in our history.
Well, I think there's ways in which we can deal with the legacy of empire without, and there's creative ways in which you can deal with it and looking at it in the context of the time without browbeating people to the point where they're just completely disengaged from the debate.
Well, we're going to move finally to Poland, which is going in the opposite direction to many countries around the globe when it comes to business on Sundays. For two Sundays a month, a new law is now banning all trade. It's the first time this has happened since the 1990s. The law was put forward by the trade union Solidarity with support from the pro-Catholic ruling party Law and Justice and has been welcomed by the Catholic Church. Geoffrey, you know, this is just, you know, a religious reflection. In this country, you used to have like really boring Sundays when you couldn't do a thing because supposedly you were home praying. Now, it's great if you refix the whole nation to follow suit, but the reality is that people will be expected to still work night shifts and work odd hours. Sunday's good because it's a time, another time when you can go and do your shopping and you can go and have a coffee and you can go and enjoy your life, isn't it?
I think that's right. I'm generally skeptical of these kinds of proposals. I see the argument for the idea that there should be a day a week that people can rely on not to have to work. But why it should be prescribed to be a particular day of the week should certainly raise our eyebrow. So even if you could come up with a good justification for having this kind of a policy, the justification that is being offered by Polish politicians is not that kind of an argument. It's clearly an argument grounded in religion, and anyone who takes separation of church and state seriously and thinks that the reasons that legislators give for laws and policies should be secular reasons that can be acceptable to anyone of a variety of different religious backgrounds, including no religion at all, this clearly doesn't fall into that category because it singles out a particular religion and says that its preferred day of worship is the day that should be the day of worship for everybody, and that this is a way of expressing that idea, and I just think that's flagrantly incompatible with the idea of a liberal secular society.
And Daniel, once society has changed, as we said, there are many Polish people who go to work on a Sunday and rely on their income from that day. They're now being told that they will not be paid on a Sunday. They may be losing, you know, 20% of their salary. Are you a supporter or not supporter?
I'm very much not a supporter. I mean, it's even more insulting. They're being told, well, you can't work on this day, but it's for your own good. Well, that's incompatible with liberal democracy. And I think it's quite clearly part of this slide by Poland into a worryingly right-wing condition. This is it's virtue signaling massively to the Catholic Church, and vast majority, maybe 90% of Poles are Catholic. But this is really signaling a return to the olden days that perhaps never existed, where Poland was defined by its Catholicism and there was massive agreement on this, and it's a hop, skip and a jump really to say this is back to the days where there was a family morality and Sunday people spent together, etc, etc, etc. I think it's more sinister than anything else.
Geoffrey, do you keep Sundays special?
Not usually. I mean, I think there is an argument here about the importance of resisting the advent of the workaholic society and making sure that people do set aside time to spend with friends and family. And I think it's not crazy to think that the state should think about how it can better support resisting a workaholic society. I think workaholics aren't good for society generally. I think there is such a thing as balance, and that's an important part of a good life. But this clearly is not what the Polish legislature has in mind with this particular policy.
Well, we're going to carry on trading 7 days a week here on Monocle 24, but for now, that brings us to the end of today's show. Daniela Pellet and Geoffrey Howard, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House. Today's show was produced by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and it was researched by Pierre-Antoine Denis, and our studio manager, that was Christy Evans. There's
more music next. Then at 1900 hours, it's Section D with Josh Fennett. We'll have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200 hours. Madrid House will be back, of course, at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time. But from me, Andrew Tuck, thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.